Well, welcome everyone to another Nexus webinar. I'm your host, Andrew Estes. I'm really looking forward to today's conversation because we're joined by someone who brings both kind of global insight and a deep pastoral experience and wisdom to the topic of disciple making. My friend Corey Hartman serves as the global voice developer at New Generations, another organization. We had Roy Moran as a guest on the webinar earlier this year, so he works a little bit with Roy as well. But New Generations, where Corey also develops and serves just disciple making movements all over the world, resourcing them and just studying and just learning a whole bunch of different things. He also is a co-author of several books, author and co-author, including one that some of our network has heard of, a Future Church book with Mr. Will Mancini, but several others as well, and working on one now, I think maybe potentially called Disciple Making Movements, but we'll unpack that a little bit. But just looking at the intentionality behind what is happening in the world, in the kingdom. And so, Corey, I'm so thankful for you joining us today and just really excited to dive into this topic together.
It's a real honor, Andrew. Thank you so very much for inviting me.
Okay, good. Well, if you would, I would love to just kind of unpack and just start out with just a little bit of your story. So for those that are unfamiliar with who you are, give us a quick flyover, like who you are, where you're from, some of your experience in ministry and what God's doing in your life now.
For sure. Well, I was a local church congregational pastor of small churches for 13 years, 3 years in North Jersey, and then 10 years where I still live now in central Pennsylvania. And at the end of 2017, December 31st, 2017, it was a Sunday, and it was my last day in pastoral ministry. I stepped down from that church with no job that I was going into. That last year of ministry was probably the hardest year of my life, and there was a lot of difficulty over the course of an extended period of time, but that really erupted anew in that last year of ministry. And as I walked away, I didn't know what I was going to do next. I thought I was still going to be a pastor, but just needed some time to heal. And what ended up happening instead is that within 2 months, I started doing something I never imagined doing, and that was to become a collaborative author with Christian leaders and organizations. So basically, there would be a really bright person with great ideas and usually very good at talking about those ideas and wanted to get those into writing somehow and had some difficulty doing that. And they would bring me along and we would talk. I would mine the genius in their mind and I would bring my own experience and expertise to bear. And we would clarify and focus and improve those ideas and then put them into writing for other people to understand. So I did that as a freelancer for a few years. And then my major client, Will Mancini, hired me on full time with an outfit that he was creating called the Future Church Company. Just before that happened, he and I wrote Future Church together. And then the company was created. That dissolved 2 years later, but over the course of time, I met someone through that organization who is the chairman of the board of New Generations, which is this organization that is a hub of indigenous mission partners around the world right now, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. And what they have in common, what we have in common, is an alliance to catalyze disciple-making movements everywhere. And so they picked me up to do the same sort of thing. And that started a deep dive in 2022 into a whole realm that I was not even aware of before, not being a missions guy myself, but learning a whole lot about incredible things that God is doing around the world. And so I'm still serving that function of taking and mining the genius and the expertise of people who have been doing this for 20 years to see these virally multiplicative disciple-making movements and putting the principles into words that can help everybody who cares about the Great Commission.
Yeah, that's fantastic, man. Before we dive into just some of the global perspectives and some of your learnings and things of that nature, I'd love to just kind of backtrack a little bit of just like in your pastoral ministry. I feel like over the last 10, 15, 20 years, like everybody has had, not everybody, but there's so many just different pastors that have been in this like disciple making conversation where there was just this angst, this shift from just Sunday to Sunday ministry and program driven ministry to actual disciple making growth, and seeing what that looks like, and just having the passion and the drive to just say like, hey, what we were doing and what we have been doing maybe served its season in the past, but it's really not advancing the commission like we feel like it should be. And just so, what was that like for you? What was that journey like? Or was that something? Or maybe you were just always all in it from day one, and you were just fantastic about all of that stuff. But what was that journey like, or that shift like for you, moving from just that program-centric model to actual disciple-making growth?
Great question, Andrew. First of all, I'll say that I'll give us a short summary of it. You can read more about it in a bonus chapter that did not make it into the print version of Future Church, but it is a chapter that had to get cut for length. But it is my own story of this whole thing, and you can find it on my website, coreyhartman.com. Basically, for me, I was trying to do with great intentions, what everybody was telling me to do that would enable a church to grow and see people saved and come to follow Jesus more deeply if they were already following Jesus somehow. And all of the different pat answers that I found didn't work. So the pat answer of just preach the Bible, not enough. The pat answer of church health will produce church growth. Not enough. The pat answer of reforming your outreach, your worship, your digital presence, your assimilation ministry, your hospitality, all of these things didn't work. We did a whole lot of things, but none of them was enough to turn the tide of participation frequency decline that we were really, all of us in every sort of church, in every sort of place, was really suffering throughout that time, and especially in an accelerated way from roughly 2010 to 2015. And what I mean by participation frequency decline is you're not losing people, but the people that you have are coming less often. And when they come less often, that has a major impact on the mood on a Sunday morning and also your volunteer strength. And it can create a death spiral where people stop coming because there aren't enough people coming. And as a small church, that was something that was really hitting us hard. And so there were this sequence of things happening. And then as we were struggling through that and trying to find our way out of that, at the same time, then there was an eruption of disunity in my church in 2016, 2017, which caused a major crisis. We lost 35% of our people in one winter. And during that time, it threw me into depression. It was a really awful year. And at the same time that was happening, I was beginning to get exposed to the disciple-making concept. And being challenged by the difference between disciple making and church growth was coming at a time that I was already emotionally messed up anyway. And so my conclusion, looking at my own ministry, was I have completely failed. I have not only destroyed a church, but also I haven't made it a single disciple along the way. That was a really bad day. I still remember that day. Now, it was that evaluation was a little overdone. It was a little overblown, but it wasn't totally wrong either. And when I walked away, then for the first time in many years, I was like an ordinary guy who was taking his family to church, which like I had never done before. And church looks really different when you're an ordinary guy taking people to church, taking your family to church. And there were all kinds of things that I was already noticing about church that just came into bright and painful awareness when I was just an ordinary dude. For example, the immense amount of time, effort, energy, money, and institutional strength that goes into making Sunday morning work. It just became incredibly apparent to me when I wasn't responsible to do it anymore. And so there were lots of things like that that were working on me, and certain things that I could only become aware of after stepping out of that role, stepping out from behind the pulpit, no longer being in that chair. And then by God's grace, being in touch then with a whole group of people who were already thinking more radical thoughts. And so then that continued on in my role as a freelance writer. And then when disciple making movement stuff came my way in 2022, I was ready for it.
Yeah, that's fantastic, man. Like, give me just walking through a lot of that stuff, just being blessed by, even a lot of your writing and thinking that influenced some of the future church content has been very formative. I mean, whether it's the upper room, lower room concept and like some of the funnel fusion and just like, but more than just the tools that were developed prior, but of being able to just read through a lot of that material has been fantastic, and really given a lot of leaders a lot of language to be able to just dialogue and wrestle with just the tension that we've all just kind of felt more in recent years. And so I'd love to just kind of fast forward, like give us a little bit of a scope of what you're currently doing with New Generations. I know I follow you on some of your newsletter, and then like just on social and whatnot, and just seeing you all over the world, all over the place. Give us the scope of what your involvement at New Generations has been like the last couple of years.
Probably, Andrew, the best place to start is the story of how I was recruited. When this colleague of mine, Roy Moran, who you mentioned him before, he's the chairman of the board of New Generations and also serves in a staff role with New Generations. He was the person that I had met through previous freelancing work, and he was the one who invited me when he discovered that my organization at that time was dissolving. He sent me a text message that said, "Hey, I heard what happened. Are you available for international travel in 2 weeks?" And I said, "What did you have in mind?" And he invited me to this event that's been happening every year for 10 years in Nairobi, Kenya, in the compound, the headquarters of a missions organization called Lifeway Global. And this event is called Catalyst Camp. So he paid for my way and invited me to go. And in this, I was seeing disciple-making movement catalysts from throughout East Africa who were gathering together to talk about what they were doing to do it better. And it was in that I began to discover that the phrase disciple-making movement meant something very different than what I thought it was. And here later in this webinar, I'll explain more of what that means. But for now, suffice it to say that my experience with that phrase up to that point, though I didn't realize it, was basically a rally cry slash marketing slogan. Okay? It's sort of like, we want to see a disciple-making movement in North America come to our conference. I mean, it was that sort of thing. It was a rally cry. It was aspirational. There was genuine heart and sincerity behind it, but there was not clear definition of what we were talking about. What I discovered was that going back to 2010, which in turn was resting on work that began to be published in 1999, outside of the church world in North America that I was used to, there were people in the international missions world who were actually using the term disciple-making movement as a technical term with specificity. It meant something particular. It was actually a phenomenological definition of something happening. And also a label for a particular approach or strategy to get that thing to happen. And this Catalyst of Camp event was bringing people together who were doing that thing. And so here I was And I was meeting people doing things that I didn't even know were happening in the world, like the best kept secret on planet Earth. And I w met a bunch of people that this applies to, but let me tell you just the brief story of one, a guy named Mark. Mark, who is an ordinary church member who then learned about the disciple making movement approach, began to do it, was threatening enough to his pastor that he got kicked out of his church, kept doing it anyway. This is a farmer, by the way, in southern Kenya. And he began to create this chain reaction with others as a team that was seeing disciples making disciples making disciples manifesting as groups spawning groups spawning groups. That within the previous 3 year or 4 years of me talking to him had resulted in 3,000 brand new disciples made in these generationally reproducing churches. Now, it occurred to me that if Mark was in the United States, he would be the bee's knees. I mean, everybody would want a piece of Mark. I mean, Mark would have his own book, he would have his podcast. He would be headlining conferences. Everybody would want to know, Mark, how did you do it? I mean, he would be the biggest thing in the world, right? In the meantime, the actual Mark is a farmer in Kenya and nobody's ever heard of him. And I was meeting all these people like this and it was blowing me away. And what I basically got recruited to do was to distill the principles of what they were doing. So what I've done since joining New Generations was, first of all, get caught up on the conversation about church planting movements and disciple making movements over the last 25 years. That took a long time. Well, the thing I did before that was to become a support raising missionary. So I raised my own support. So to get people to pay me to do what I do, to contribute to do what I do. And then I did a whole lot of research. And then I assimilated a whole lot of our own thought within New Generations. And then I began working with our CEO, Harry Brown, to take his particular thoughts on the topic, which have not been adequately projected into the rest of the world, and to put those into a book. And so he and I have been working on a book together that's to try to synthesize a whole lot of this stuff. And that book is still in process now. And we sincerely hope that book, which may indeed be called Disciple Making Movements, comes out at the end of this year or early next year. And in the meantime, what I still do with New Generations is continue to travel around the world to learn more and more, because it seems to be a bottomless well of learning about DMM. I never have not yet gotten to the end of all that there is to know about it. And to continue to then help our alliance of organizations across the world to have better harmony in how we talk about it so that it's easier for us to help more people to do this thing that we've seen God doing across multiple continents.
That's fantastic, man. Well, I'd love to just kind of dump in or jump into like some of that content and just, I mean, from our perception of what we think DMM actually stands for. I'd love to kind of get clear definition on that and some of the principles. But I know you mentioned you had maybe some slides to kind of share with us. Is that in those slides or is that something we talk about now?
Yeah, it is. I'll share my screen here and we can begin to get into this. And first, let me just say that as you've noticed, I'm greatly capable of monologuing. Okay. So
I was counting on it, man. Like, if you can just carry the weight of the conversation, I'll just sit back and listen. It's
well,
fantastic. So.
yeah, so I have a friend who refers to my style of talking as Senate filibuster. Okay. So that
Our director says that he's like he's got a doctorate and like two master's degrees, and one of the phrases he says is like, I can talk about nothing for a really long time and feel really good about it.
I resonate with that dude. I really do. So that's all to say, please interrupt my monologue and make it dialogue. Okay, so jump in and interrupt me and ask me questions. All right, throw it out there. All right, and we'll break it up. So I'm gonna rely on you to break my flow when it needs to be broken. So the way I want to start here is to talk a bit about something that my guess is that most of the listeners today, and I know you, Andrew, for sure, have heard about and have talked about, and this is the concept of oikos, okay? So oikos being the Greek word meaning home or household, and it being basically the substructure, the social structure within the Greco-Roman world. And in recent years, there's been a fair amount of talk about among disciple makers and church planters about thinking through how things happened in the New Testament as the gospel spread from oikos to oikos to oikos, and to think about how we can apply those same principles here in our place and day, and how we can do that. And so I want to talk about that again, because I even talk about that, Will and I talk about that in Future Church. And as I've entered into the DMM space, DMM stands for Disciple Making Movements, it's actually gotten me to refocus and understand a bit sharper what oikos really looked like in the Greco-Roman world, because we actually see it play out in the developing world today. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about oikos in the Greco-Roman world, and then I'm going to show and talk about how the gospel spread in a viral replicative way, and how church started church started church started church in the first century to the third century. But then also talk about how we see the same sort of pattern going on in disciple-making movements in the rural developing world, and then shift from there into our context, which is an urban context. And how is the urban context different, like really powerfully different from those situations? And how do those principles cross over, and how do they not cross over? So that's the outline of where we're going to go. And along the way, we're going to see some things about DMM, and we're going to see how it contrasts in some ways with church planting as we know it. So to start with, here's just a diagram to describe what the oikos basically was in the first century Roman and Greco-Roman society. So in that circle on your left, you see in the center of the circle this guy called the pater familias. So pater familias is Latin for father of the family. And the pater familias was the center of the household. The oikos there is that large circle that the pater familias is the center of. And that includes his wife, his children, his slaves. And as you can remember in the book of Ephesians and in the book of Colossians, Paul gives what are called the house tables, the so-called house tables, where he gives instructions about how those relationships should be in an oikos that's a Jesus-following oikos. Okay. So he describes what should the relationships be, how should the pater familias treat his wife and vice versa, his child and vice versa, his slave and vice versa. And then we also see this character on the edge of the circle called the client. And the client is sort of in the oikos and sort of not, because the client is a pater familias himself, but he is less powerful and has less wealth and has less resources than the pater familias. And so he's in an unequal relationship where the pater familias does favors for the client, and the client, to the extent of his ability, does favors back to the pater familias. But the main thing he does is show loyalty and give praise and honor. And if you want to see this illustrated really well, just watch the first scene of The Godfather, where Bonasera, the undertaker, is talking to Don Corleone. Okay? Because that is an illustration. Don Corleone is the pater familias, Bonasera is the client, and he is coming to Don Corleone to ask for a favor. And that is the relationship that you're seeing played out there. So this is the oikos. Now, the pater familias also then is a member of a social circle of his peers, and you see that on the right. These are all sorts of different pater familiae. Familii who are in his city, and these are all peers, and they relate to one another. Now, in the circle, they're all equal, but in reality, they're not all equal. Some are more powerful than others, right? And some, their oikos is larger. They have more slaves. They have more wealth. They have more clients. Others, their circle is smaller. They have no slaves. They have no clients, and everywhere in between. But this is basically the social structure of the Roman world. So here's what happened when the gospel entered this space. When the gospel entered the Roman world, then the gospel, if it was accepted, if it was embraced by a pater familias, then that pater familias would then spread the gospel within his oikos, and it would take over the oikos. So, for example, we see this in Acts chapter 16 with the jailer in Philippi. He brings in Paul and Silas. We actually see it twice in Philippi. So I should go back. First, we see it with Lydia. Lydia, even though she's a woman, is actually functioning as paterfamilias of a household. And that did happen from time to time. And she was a businesswoman who is capable of doing that. But then we see the jailer who, after the earthquake, and he's about to kill himself, then Paul says, "Don't kill yourself. We're all still here." He falls at their feet. He says, "Men, masters, what should I do to be saved?" And Paul says, "Repent in the name and believe in the Lord Jesus Christ and be baptized, you and your household." And so that all happens in one night. Okay. And so it's not as though Paul was, praying the sinner's prayer individually with each of the people in the household. That's not what it was. The jailer said, "I'm into Christ." He looks at his oikos. He says, "We're into Christ. We're all doing it." And so that happens. And so once that jailer then comes to Christ and his whole household does, then that jailer is now taking that to all of his peers. Well, imagine that you're not the paterfamilias. Imagine that you're one of the other people in the household. So imagine, for example, that you're a slave. Well, if you're a slave, then what are you doing once you come to know Christ? Well, for one thing, you're telling your fellow slaves in the household. And you're also telling your master. And you're also telling his wife. And it may be that the master comes to believe through you, his slave. It may be that his wife comes to believe and then she works on her husband and then he comes to believe. So it ends up working that way. But once it turns the key on the master, on the husband, then it affects the whole rest of the household. In the meantime, the slave also has a social circle, as on the right, and that's slaves in other people's households. So he's telling other slaves in other households, and they're coming to know Jesus, and then they're doing the same in their oikos that he's doing in his oikos. But it all ends up turning on the paterfamilias. But once it does, then that domicile, like that oikos, it becomes a church. Like it becomes a meeting. But then also all of the different meetings throughout the city, they together become a meeting. And even if they're not a meeting because it grows larger than anyone can host, still all that whole network of all of these Christian oikoi throughout the city, that is the gathering. That is the church. So that's how it worked in the first century. And it was through these networked relationships, these networked oikoi, that the gospel spread throughout the world. Well, the really cool thing that I discovered is that's still happening today. That's still happening right now in the developing world, especially in rural areas. Now, imagine that you are a church planter. And you are going into a village in the developing world. Okay. Now, these circles that you see, these are families. And when in developing traditional cultures, in traditional cultures, when they talk about family, they don't mean what you and I, Andrew, mean when we talk about family. Like when I think about family, I think about my wife and my kids who live in my house. And then beyond that, they are my extended family, right? That's not how they think in traditional societies. The extended family is your family, okay? And so it's very family-based, it's very clan-based. And so a church planter goes into a village. And here in this village, you have all these different families, and each one has a head of the family. Now, imagine that you're going to do traditional church planting and evangelism, where you're going through that village and you're telling people about Jesus. You're knocking on doors, you're telling people about Jesus, you're handing out tracts, maybe you're preaching on the street corner, maybe you have like a crusade, you bring the Jesus film in, you set up a big screen, you show the movie. At the end of it, you ask how many people want to be saved. You do this sort of thing. You're trying to win lost individual people. And then when you have a critical mass of them, you're going to found a church. Now, based on what we've talked about, Andrew, so far, I'm actually going to pause my long monologue. And just ask you how you think if the church planter does that and begins to get successful, how do you think that the heads of families in this village are going to interpret what it is that he's doing. What do you think that they think he's doing while he does that?
That's a good question, man. I'm actually not 100% sure.
Okay. All right. Well, here's one thing they're going to think that he's doing is they're going to be suspicious of the gospel that he's preaching in general, right? You know, if it is disrupting what they're already believing as animists or as Muslims or as Buddhists or as Hindus, then there's going to be issues right there. But there's something else that also creates wariness, and that is this. What they see the church planter doing is waltzing into a village where there are already circles and basically announcing, I'm creating a new circle. And I am seeking individuals from your circles to draw into my new circle. Now,
Interesting.
how do you think that comes across? I mean, that's pretty threatening, right? Here's this guy from someplace else who's actually coming to like poach people from my circle. People that I basically lead, okay? They submit to me, and this person's coming and he wants them to listen to him. And that sets up a power struggle where, say, the son in one of these families says, "I believe in Jesus." And the father says, "What? You're going to listen to
Yeah.
this guy over me?" Or the wife says, "I believe in Jesus. What, you're going to listen to this guy over me, your husband?" And then that is where the conflict start, you know, really rises. That's where persecution rises. That's where these individuals can be beaten and forced to try to comply. Many of them fall away under persecution. And in some cases, those who will not fall away under persecution will be banished from their household. You know, they will be kicked out and they're gone. They're a man without a family. They lose all their family and all their friends all at once. And if the church is successful, then at best it becomes a sort of enclave within the community that then the rest of the community sort of hermetically seals off from, right? That's their thing, that's their place, but we're not them. And that's as far as it goes. And then that is as far as the gospel advances in that village. Now, here is a different approach. Here's a DMM approach. So, in a DMM approach, you have disciple makers. And notice how I have more than one of them because they usually go as a team. In this case, I have three. And what the disciple makers do in this village is they don't start by giving the four spiritual laws. By preaching the gospel, by inviting people to pray a prayer or to come forward or whatever. And they're also not saying we're starting a church. They're not holding worship services. What they're doing is they're doing good and telling stories. That's what they're doing. They do what Jesus told his disciples to do in Matthew 10 and in Luke 10, go into the city, announce the good news of the kingdom of God, and heal people. And so they come in, and in various ways, they do practical good for the community. That can be practical good in terms of having a school or digging a well or starting a business that provides supplies that aren't available in that community. You know, so business as mission is definitely possible. What it always involves is praying for people, always. It always involves saying, looking for people and say, how can I pray for you? And to pray for them in Jesus' name and to heal people. It always involves that sort of thing. And while they're doing this, they tell stories from the Bible. They tell stories, Jesus stories. They tell other stories from the Old Testament. They tell all sorts of stories that are relevant to the situations that they're finding day by day. And people love stories. And so they hear these stories. And as this happens, they actually become respected within the community as those who do good and care about the community. And as they do this, and as they go along, then they begin to find that there's somebody in that community that God has already been working on. And that person is the person of peace. Now, you may have heard of the person of peace before. That might be a familiar concept because that's also something that we hear a lot today in the West, and it is a concept. Who is your person of peace? Who is the person that God has already put in your life, that God has prepared to receive you? Somebody who receives you, someone who respects you, someone who likes you, someone who wants to be discipled by you, the person that already there's grace on that person to receive you and bring you in. That's how we generally talk about applying the person of peace concept in the West. And those things are true, but they're incomplete. To look at Matthew 10 and to look at Luke 10, one of the key characteristics of a person of peace is that the person has a house, and that that person actually has the wherewithal and the authority to say, you guys can come in and stay here, which means that he's not just anybody who's interested. He's somebody who's interested, who's also a paterfamilias, who's also a head of household, who, if he says these guys can stay here, they're going to stay there. Like, nobody can dispute that. Okay. And so he has some sort of dominance within his circle, within his oikos, to invite people in. And so sometimes the disciple makers will find that that head of household within the village, within the community, is interested and wants to know more about this good news, wants to know more about this Jesus person, wants to know more about the God that these disciple makers serve. Sometimes it doesn't start with him or her, but it's a son or a spouse or someone else, and that person will be interested, and then we'll go to his dad, go to her husband, and say, hey, I want these people to come. Will you let them come? Yeah, okay, they can come in. And then once that happens, once they come in, they begin to read scripture, recite Bible stories together with them. This is a longer story. I'm not going to get into all of it. But over a period of time, that entire oikos, that entire household believes. They start to follow Jesus, and it becomes a gathering. It becomes an ecclesia, what we traditionally translate church in English, even though what we think of as a church doesn't really match up real well with what the ecclesia was in the New Testament or what it is here in this village. And then the different people from this new gathering, then they reach in touch with their friends in all of the other homes, all the other families in the village, and it spreads that way, and gathering spawns gathering spawns gathering, and that can continue for generations. It's an incredible thing that takes place. And this is that replicative multiplicational disciple making that then extends throughout the community, from that community to other communities, from those communities to other tribes, other peoples, other places, and it becomes this multiplicational thing. And to this day, over the last 20 years, we've seen 3.1 million new followers of Jesus in 160,000 churches, gatherings like this one, through this approach. So I'll pause and
Wow.
let you respond to that.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously is super fascinating. I think, especially when you're talking about the paterfamilias, where we just think that is our immediate family, right? And we just think of like household as just me, my wife, my kids, like, and then everything else is external. How does that tension in the West kind of play into this type of model of disciple making that's so effective in more of those traditional valued, like familial, like oikos type of gathering communities, like when we're much more isolated in the West, just, or individualistic, or even just like have a smaller view of what our oikos is. How does that affect how we do disciple making?
I'm so glad you asked, Andrew. That is the million-dollar question. And let me show you. So let me go back to the first century a second, just as a reminder. This is what the oikos looked like in the first century, where you have a big oikos with a powerful man in the center, and then that man has connections with other powerful men who are the center of their own circle. Here's what relationships look like. Here's what the structure of society looks like where we live. It looks like this. So in our situation, it's not based on the household, it's based on the individual. Like you said, it's based on the autonomous individual. And rather than the individual being a part of one major circle that is that person's life, whether he or she is the center of that circle or not in the center of it, instead, we have the autonomous individual who's a part of multiple circles. There's a lot of circles that we're a part of. I got my fam this person here. I got my family circle. I got my work circle. I got my kids' sports team circle. I got a couple of different friend groups, and I'm a part of each of them, and none of them is nearly as powerful or life-defining as like the single circle that the first century person was in, or that the person in a traditional culture is in. And in the meantime, I have all of these one-on-one friendships. I got these one-on-one relationships that are hither and yon and all over the place that like isn't part of a group. It's just this one guy or this one gal, this one person. And by the way, these groups also, especially now, and definitely the individuals, they're not even local. Like some of them are local, but some of them are like all over the country or all over the world, right? So it's like massively geographically distributed. And while there can be some overlap among these circles where some of these people know each other, a lot of them are like massively fragmented where nobody knows anybody else and the only link is me. So this is the reality of urban society. And the West is thoroughly urbanized. I mean, it's so urbanized that even rural areas are semi-urban from a global point of view. Like what I like to say is if you can get in your pickup and be at Walmart in 30 minutes, then you're urban from a global point of view. Okay. You're kind of semi-urban, but you're still not rural from a developing world point of view. And so this different social structure radically changes things. So what does this end up looking like for church planting? So, for one thing, if you're the church planter and you're in the middle of this, here's what you're typically doing. Once again, like I described with the church planter in the developing world, you're basically trying to create a new circle in the middle of all the other circles that already exist and that people are living their lives in. And you're trying to persuade people to join your circle, that is this new circle that you're starting out. And doing that in the West has a combination of opportunity, disappointment, and threat. The opportunity of it is that, especially if you're operating in a place where there's still a pretty high degree of cultural Christianity, is that you actually can draw in some people's families or social circles that way. And the reason for that is that if God is working on somebody and the Father is drawing somebody to the Son, and that person is living in a society that's still culturally Christian, then the first thing that comes to their head is, I need to go to church. Okay? So like that's still present in largely culturally Christian regions or communities in different Western cultures. I need to go to church. And so there still is opportunity to draw people in that way. There is, however, disappointment that is a possibility too because of the threat. You still are a threat. If you're a church planter, you still are a threat. It's not as severe a threat to the center of the circle in the West, or the center of the circle in an urban environment, as it is to the center of the circle somewhere else, because there's probably not going to be beatings. There's probably not going to be radical exclusion. And the boundaries are more porous. But keep in mind that you are asking for somebody's time. And time in the West is the most precious commodity. So if you're saying, come into my circle, you're saying, I want you to give me some of your precious time. Well, where are they going to take that time from? They're going to take that time from their other circles. And so that's going to mean a genuine loss to somebody else. And so there is a threat that happens. And so what can happen then is the person who's the center of some other circle, they'll let their wife go, but like that's her thing and I'm not going. Or they'll let their friend go, but it's like, well, we used to hang out, but we don't really hang out anymore now that he goes to that church. And so, even if you succeed in growing your circle, what you can actually do is actually wall it off from the other circles that you would love to get into, who now are like, well, I lost my friend, I lost my spouse, I lost my kid to that other thing. And you become limited as to how much you can touch your community. So that's the danger, that even when it works, it doesn't work. Okay. So what do we do instead? Well, it's half-baked. We're still experimenting. We don't have perfect proof of concept yet, although we're getting closer. And I heard some great examples last weekend of getting closer. But I'll show you some things that can happen if you try to take a more DMM approach to planting the gospel in a multiplicative way. The one thing is, persons of peace do still exist. That's the best case scenario. There are still people, and you can think of it this way. If you think of that work group, that friend group, whatever, who is the person in that group that if he or she says, we're doing this, that everybody else is going to go along and do it? I mean, every group has that person. And that person is still the sort of person who can invite the disciple makers in and say, hey, friends, let's come over and let's do this thing. And most of them are going to come. It won't be as thorough as in the developing world, where if the head of household says come, he says jump, everybody says how high, but you're still going to get some of them. And that can still happen, and that can still become a gathering, and that can still spread throughout the society. It's much smaller. Now you're looking at a circle of like four people rather than 24 people, but it can still happen. The second thing that can happen is the lonely people. So we have a lot of lonely people in the West who, frankly, they're not a part of anybody's circle. They're super lonely people. And if you're making disciples and you encounter a lonely person who doesn't even have a circle, and the Father's drawing them to the Son, well, you're not going to start a replicating disciple making movement through that person, but you can still disciple them, and as you draw in some of those lonely people, you can form a new circle of these lonely people who now have a home that they didn't have a home before. And you're not threatening anybody else, because nobody else is losing them, but you're drawing them together into a circle of lonely people who have now found a home. And they found that home in Christ. So that is still a realistic thing that you can totally do and that we have to do in the West. And then the third thing is, what if you are the person of peace? Okay. So, in other words, that person who's like the center of the circle that everybody, listens to, you might be that in some circle. Like, you might be the person in a friend group who, if you say, we're going to this thing, that everybody goes. And if you are, recognize that and leverage that to do discovery Bible study, which is another topic. But to do that and turn your gathering, your social circle into a gathering, not as the nucleus of a new church, though you could do that, but as the vehicle then to send all of those people out to enter into other social circles. So those are three different like avenues or options you can take to apply these principles in the West.
So you referred to kind of our basic definition of what we typically define like a person of peace as somebody who's like open to receiving the gospel, more or less. How would you give a better definition of what a person of peace is today? Is it just somebody who is basically an influencer, or somebody who has the potential of opening a network of gospel influence in other circles? Or how do you just give me a simple, clear, better definition for a person of peace for us?
It's the combination of both of those things. It's those two things together. In fact, Harry Brown, the guy that I'm helping write this book, he has a great way of phrasing it. He says a person of peace has two things: spiritual interest and community influence. Those are the two attributes of the person of peace.
That's good.
In a very often in a Western or urbanized situation, that community influence might be very confined. I mean, it might be a micro community of four or five people. It might be a gang, it might be a clique, right? Whatever. Or it could be a lot larger, right? That's also very possible. I mean, you could be the owner of a small business that employs 30 people, right? But it's the combination of spiritual interest and community influence. That's what makes somebody a person of peace. If somebody has spiritual influence, you want to lead that person to become a follower of Jesus, period. But if that person has community influence also, then the way to do it is not to draw that person into your circle, but to enter theirs.
Yeah.
And allow that person to continue to lead their circle, but now do so leading that circle to Jesus, even as they themselves are being led to Jesus.
Yeah, and this is because I would even think even in the more traditional type of culture and mindset, when you have like that oikos, the paterfamilia, just that circle that then becomes like the house, like the ecclesia, it's easy for that to just remain right there. Just the
That's right.
same as our church like pulls people from their oikos just to create our own, and it's easy for us to just remain right there. But that influence of the community influence and the person of peace nature, do you feel like that that's one of those things that maybe one of the things that to help shift our established program driven churches towards the recognition of the influence and the I mean just speak to that for a second of like what is one kind of thing that we can do to help overcome just that paradigm shift of rather than just come and be a part of our oikos of like no we need to equip and send and think about it in a different way to really be able to train people to just think of themselves as influencers with the gospel rather than like hey just keep inviting people to our oikos.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's so true, Andrew. I do think that thinking about things this way can open that up. And yet there's another piece too that's really important having to do with replication. And the reason that replication is so important is because to use the upper room, lower room illustration from Future Church, it is totally possible to recreate the lower room in the living room. I mean, like that is completely possible, right? I mean,
That's so good.
you can have your house church that is like this like low overhead, super communal, lightweight, low maintenance thing that's still basically just lower room because we've got our personality, place, people, and program that we like, and it just happens to be here on a Sunday morning in our pajamas, I mean, so that house church by itself does not give you the upper room, not in any way, shape, or form. There still needs to be that mission drivenness, and there still needs to be replication. So, what we mean by replication, we at New Generations, we're increasingly using replication as our favored word above multiplication. We still say multiplication, we're not anti the word multiplication. But the reason that we like the word replication better is that what we mean by it is that the process goes with the gospel. So it means that when I am making disciples, I am not just passing the message to them, but I am passing it in a capsule that actually is a process that they can and will repeat with other people. So our vehicle of doing that is something that maybe some of our listeners here today have experienced, but it's something called Discovery Bible Study, or the initials are DBS. And there's a bunch of different very legitimate variations of DBS. It's not just one thing, but there are certain things about it that are essentials. They're like the load-bearing walls that if it doesn't have these things, it's not a DBS. And one of those is it's basically a sequence or a series of questions that in its absolutely ultra distilled form is taking a passage of scripture and say, what does it say? What does it mean? What will you do about it? And who will you tell? That fourth question, who will you tell, means that you're going to repeat this story that you learned to somebody else. As you do that during the week or between sessions, sometimes the people you tell will want to know more. And at that moment that they want to know more, the person who is telling them has a choice. The one thing they could say is, well, why don't you come on Tuesday? Because we're going to do this again and you could hear more. They could invite to their own. That is not replication. Replication is, why don't you get your oikos together? I'll come to your place and we'll do it there. That's replication, right? And so the process goes with the gospel. It empowers every single person who hears, ordinary people, illiterate people, people who are uneducated, people who aren't super charismatic, they're not that smart, they're not that influential, but to the extent that they do have influence with a friend, they can enter into that person's circle and repeat the process that was given to them. When that replicational approach to gospel transfer is going along, that's when it can really go viral. That's when it can really extend to generation upon generation upon generation upon generation of disciples and gatherings.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I know we're running short on time, but I just ran into this issue, I think, just even this week in my own context. But how do you help leaders overcome the tension of it's basically just releasing that authority? I mean, you guys talk about it a lot in the Future Church content and things like that, but just being able to entrust somebody to go and do this. Maybe they're not, you know, I mean, we have all these like stipulations of like what we require for people to be like hired in ministry and stuff like that. And sometimes we just put that on other people. Have they been to Bible college? Like, do they know XYZs or like household in order and all? I mean, just almost like elder level, like qualifications that we just put on the basic like person that might be sharing the gospel or like being able to lead a DBS. What are some things that you've kind of noticed to help kind of break down maybe some of those presuppositions or the tension of releasing that authority?
Well, a big part of it, Andrew, is determining on the front end that your process is for sharing the gospel is going to make the Bible its own content expert. So it's to make the Bible the teacher, not the person, the teacher using the Bible. So I've had a heck of a lot of education and a heck of a lot of practice being a teacher who uses the Bible to teach. And I found that that's a different thing from the Bible itself being the teacher. So when the Bible itself is the teacher, that is taking scripture. And to be fair, it's a particular passage or sequence of passages of scripture that has been chosen by somebody wise who has a good idea of what would be a good set of scriptures that all together would present the gospel. Okay, so there is an art to that. That's not something you want to just hand off to anybody. But with that set of scriptures being determined, that then an ordinary person with a set of scriptures and a process that can be facilitated then is capable themselves of taking that, leading a group of people through the process. And again, it's through a process. It's facilitating a process. It's not explaining. It's not answering questions. It's not telling anybody anything. It's just saying, I have a story. I have a set of questions. We're going to read the story. I'm going to ask the questions. We're all going to answer the questions. My only job is to keep us on track with answering the questions. But that's it. Nobody has any answers. All of our answers are just seeking in the text itself. What does it say? What does it mean? What am I going to do about it? Who am I going to tell? And that's it. And yeah, what I've found is that a person whom God is working in and drawing, who does not know very much, if God is working in them, is quite capable of doing that thing. Now, as things develop, does that person need coaching? Yes. Do they need mentoring? Yes. Do they need more training? Absolutely. Do they need teaching? For sure. But instead of the slogan of lost people found, found people formed people sent, the DMM approach is lost people found people sent people formed. They're being formed in the sending. Those things are happening simultaneously, not sequentially.
That's fantastic. Well, dude, in full like inductive sermon style, we should have hit this right up front, but I would love to get it from the guy who wrote the book or is writing the book in partnership. Give us as succinctly as you can a clear definition of what is a disciple making movement, because it is a buzzword. Like, we've been just talking about it and for the last 15 plus years, and like everybody talks about wanting to launch a movement and start. Like, in your experience, in your understanding, in your research, what is a disciple making movement?
The idea, the framing that we are increasingly coalescing around is that a disciple making movement is first and foremost a chain reaction. It is a chain reaction of ordinary people who are making disciples who obey everything Jesus commands through their natural social networks, shown up in, resulting in generations of gatherings, spawning gatherings. And this chain reaction maintains its quality without depending on the people who started it. That's a disciple-making movement.
That's fantastic, man. Well, Corey, dude, thank you so much. I could sit here and talk to you for hours and just listening to stories and all the things, but I'm so grateful for just who you are, your contribution. Can't wait for the new book to come out. Would love to have you and Harry, or just Harry or whatever, come back in maybe next year when that book comes out. Would love to just kind of continue to unpack these principles with you, man. Thank you so much.
Amen. Can't wait. I love you. I'm so glad for your friendship. And I'm just so honored that you've invited me to be able to talk to your awesome network. So God bless.
Absolutely. Thanks, man. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.